Welcome to this fifth Wednesday Forthright Radio for November 29th, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. Today, we welcome back Henry Giroux, public intellectual, prolific writer, culture critic, scholar, and one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy. He has spent a lifetime asking and analyzing important, hard, even scary questions such as these, which I quote in his essay, Thinking Dangerously, The Role of Higher Education in Authoritarian Times. What happens to democracy when the President of the United States labels critical media outlets as enemies of the people and disparages the search for truth with the blanket term fake news? What happens to democracy when individuals and groups are demonized on the basis of their religion? What happens to a society when critical thinking becomes an object of contempt? What happens to a social order ruled by an economics of contempt that blames the poor for their condition and subjects them to a culture of shaming? What happens to a polity when it retreats into private silos and becomes indifferent to the use of language deployed in the service of a panicked rage, language that stokes anger but ignores issues that matter? What happens to a social order when it treats millions of undocumented immigrants as disposable, potential terrorists, and criminals? What happens to a country when the presiding principles of its society are violence and ignorance? We'll be discussing these and other questions during this hour, and it may surprise you to learn that Henry Giroux's analysis, although clear-sighted in the face of the forces of dystopia, leads to an energized, engaged vision of collective agency and action. Henry Giroux currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest, and he is the author of more than 65 books. He has published more than 400 papers, in addition to hundreds of chapters in the books of others, as well as many essays and articles in such journals as Truth Out, Truth Dig, and Counterpunch. His works have been translated into many, many languages. He is particularly interested in what he calls the war on youth, the corporatization of higher education, the politics of neoliberalism, the assault on civic literacy, and the collapse of public memory, public pedagogy, the educative nature of politics, and the rise of various youth movements across the globe. His latest book is America at War with Itself, published by City Lights Books. His book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, is to be published in 2018 by Routledge. I could take up much of the hour in continuing with a more complete introduction, but instead, let's just get on with our interview. We welcome you back to Forthright Radio, Professor Henry Giroux.
Hi, Joy.
Thank you so much for joining us again today on Forthright Radio. I want to begin by noting that yesterday, November 29th, marked the 153rd anniversary of one of the best-known of scores of mass killings of Indians in the history of North America, the Sand Creek Massacre of the Cheyenne and Arapaho on the eastern plains of what is now Colorado. It was 1864. And on that anniversary, President Trump was scheduled to honor Navajo elders, code talkers, veterans of World War II, who had played a vital role in transmitting information, which the Japanese codebreakers were unable to translate, and that was they were using their own native language. Henry, as we have this conversation, we remember that each of us, all of us, live on land that was taken through violence from the native peoples of this continent. Now, you published in 2016 the book America's Addiction to Terrorism. Let us begin there. How and why do you believe America is addicted to terrorism? Many in this country see us primarily as a victim of terrorism.
Terrorists can be defined as people who want to provoke society's worst impulses and expose its hidden weaknesses. And it seems to me that the United States has been at war with the issue of democracy for quite some time. And it was a country founded on genocide. It's a country that lacks any sense of historical memory, that's willing to be self-reflective about its own crimes. And it's a country that believes in foreign policy. It's saturated in its attack on youth, on workers, on education. It's saturated in its attack on Muslims. And I think in that sense, I think we need to revive and rethink the notion of domestic terrorism so that it doesn't sound as if it's just something that happens to us by some foreign power, but that, in fact, the government can resort to policies and practices that in many ways represent a form of domestic terrorism, that put a country, put a people at risk, impose arbitrary violence, and cause massive suffering and exploitation.
You have worked for decades trying to make a more humane form of democracy. And over the last decades, there has been a decline in the humaneness of democracy, not just in this country, but around the world. And you've done a great deal of analysis on that. Could you please illuminate this process for our listeners?
Well, I think that the notion of democracy has been hijacked. It's been hijacked in the name of racism. It's been hijacked in the name of a savage form of capitalism called neoliberalism. And it's been hijacked in ways that suggest that it doesn't work by virtue of emptying out all the conditions that make it possible. You know, schools of education has been transformed into training. Economic, systemic conditions that cause all kinds of problems are now individualized or are claimed to be the result of immigrants or so-called others, you know, whether they're immigrants or Muslims or Syrians or whatever. I mean, it's a country that's involved in a massive form of displacement. And I think when you couple its ultra-nationalism and its white supremacy legacy with an economy that separates any sense of activity from social cost, you create a culture of cruelty and you create a culture of indifference. And I think that we have now seen that Frankenstein monster that's been brewing for a long time, particularly since the 1970s, when all of a sudden the social contract seemed to be a burden and democracy seemed to be an excess. And with Reagan, of course, it all really begins. I mean, in the United States, at least. It had already begun in Chile and other places as a result of a number of intellectuals under Milton Friedman from the University of Chicago. But I think that here, what we've seen since the 1980s is a growing hardening of the culture, a growing massive inequality in wealth and power, a growing disregard for the planet, a growing disregard for what I call social investments, investments that speak to a long-term future for future generations. This is not a country that believes in long-term investments. It only believes in short-term investments. And it believes that those investments can be made without any sense of ethical and moral responsibility. That's a prescription for fascism. I mean, that's a prescription for a form of social death. That's a prescription for disposability. And I think that one of the things that we don't talk enough about is when you look at the emergence of this really savage economy and the people who support it, the ultra-rich and the big corporations, and you couple that with the massive kind of suffering that it's producing, you have something new emerging, and it's what I call the politics of disposability. You know, more and more groups are seen as disposable, are seen as redundant, are seen as excess, whether we're talking about poor black youth, whether we're talking about Mexican immigrants, whether we're talking about dreamers, whether we're talking about people who basically are unemployed, whether we're talking about the sick, who have enormous health conditions, and, you know, you have a Congress that refuses to want to provide them with health insurance. It goes on and on. And I think that what we now find ourselves is looking into the abyss of authoritarianism. I mean, it's not a democracy anymore. Even the Princeton study that came out a few years ago that said that policies over a period of, 50 or 60 years, 95% of them had nothing to do with what people really wanted. They basically were policies being written up to benefit the rich. And now with this tax reform bill and this health care bill and the budget, you really see in very, very clear terms a country that is entirely organized around two things, the production of violence, and organized around doing everything it can to consolidate the wealth and the power of the upper 10%.
That brings up the whole concept of nation versus global. You have written about the counter-revolutionary global capitalism, the rise of oligarchs, plutocrats, global gangster capitalism. As you were alluding to, this current tax bill, some of the senators are actually saying that they are aware that it's not popular, but they don't have any choice because their donors have told them that if they don't do exactly what is in this bill, they won't donate to them anymore.
That's just a frank admission of how corrupt they are. I mean, at one level, I'm not even sure why we should be surprised anymore. I mean, you know, lobbyists run the government. We know that. You don't have a democracy in the United States. You don't have a federal government that basically is for and by the people. You have a government that's run by corporations. It's run by lobbyists. It's run by people with enormous amounts of wealth and power. It's run by people like the Koch brothers. I mean, and everything that Donald Trump does makes that very clear. So I'm not sure why we should be surprised by that. I think that what we should note is that they no longer have to apologize for it. There are no codes anymore to hide this kind of concentrated power. Now it's sort of like, oh, well, yeah, that's how it is. It's become normalized. And I think it's an indication of the degree to which democracy has slipped away in the United States. I mean, all over the world, to go back to your earlier question, all over the globe, you know, we're seeing the rise of what is called the liberal democracy. You know, you see it in Poland, you see it in Hungary. Countries coming out now and saying democracy has failed. It doesn't work anymore. We need a strong man. We need to eliminate human rights. We can't be concerned about civil liberties. These things just get in the way. You know, we really just have to drive the economy in ways that make us a world power. I mean, this is a prescription for global fascism. And I think that when you have a president of the United States who is in bed basically with almost every dictator on the planet and seems to be an enormous admiration of people like Putin and the head of China, and not to mention the murderous Duterte in the Philippines, I think it should become clear where we are and what has to be done and how we've got to reclaim this language of democracy. We've got to ask ourselves, you know, what does it mean? What does a democracy look like? I mean, how do we define it? I mean, what is it supposed to do? And then ask ourselves, where are the institutions that make it possible? And then ask ourselves, what is it going to mean collectively to reclaim those institutions so that we don't get caught in the trap of believing that capitalism and democracy are the same thing? They're not the same thing.
Henry, I'm aware that some, perhaps many, of our listeners, at least in the recent past, have been pretty solid Trump supporters. And in trying to discuss the issues with people who are Trump supporters, what comes up is, that's your version of truth, this is my version of truth. It seems that we can't even agree on what truth is anymore. How does one get out of that abyss?
You get out of the abyss by rejecting the framing issue. The framing issue that is that truth is all relative and such a thing as truth, and that the only thing that matters are opinions. And I think that what we have to ask ourselves is, you know, how in fact does one assume a moral and ethical position, not to mention a scientifically literate position, about anything, if one believes that? I mean, that's an argument for depoliticizing people. I don't think anybody should buy into a notion of alternative facts and fake news and all that stuff without realizing or at least trying to understand or coming to an understanding that what that takes away is your ability to make decisions and to be an informed citizen in ways that you can basically discern between fiction and reality. If you can't discern between fiction and reality, you've lost your sense of agency. You've lost your sense of power. You lost your ability to name evil. You've lost your ability to, in any way, imagine a future different than the one that you live in, actually. You lost your way to speak to those conditions that need to be addressed, over which you need some control to be able to learn how to govern rather than simply be governed.
I have made attempts to try to posit science and what I consider to be facts, and people are not necessarily open to that. And more neuroscience is indicating that we are kind of hardwired not to hear things we don't want to hear. How does one get around that?
I get the argument, and I'm sure there's some scientific evidence to suggest that. But that, you know, you got to be careful with these kinds of arguments because they tend to ignore questions of historical, political, social, and cultural context. You know, look, people learn how to be stupid. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, you're really talking about forms of pedagogy that make people dumb. I mean, just look at celebrity culture. And I think that the real question to ask here is, what are the pedagogical forces at work in the country at multiple levels and in multiple spheres that are in a sense destroying any notion of civic culture, you know, that's destroying any notion of civic literacy, that basically is pushing a form of unbridled individualism that in many ways is saying that shared citizenship doesn't matter, that we don't have to come to some sort of agreement about what we have in common, that what we believe is simply about opinions and not about evidence and standards of reference and modes of verification, that there are no commanding visions in America. Everybody has their own vision. This is nonsense. I mean, I think the real question becomes, you know, who benefits from this? You know, how do you now link these kinds of attributes and these really demeaning ideologies to relations of power? Who's spreading this stuff? Who benefits from it? Who basically hides behind a discourse in where you can't discern fact from fiction? I mean, what does it mean when a president of the United States says that video that appeared a few years ago in which he was on the bus talking about grabbing women by their genitals, that wasn't his voice? He now doesn't believe that was his voice. I mean, my God, you've got a psychopath in the White House. And I think, given those circumstances, we had better learn very quickly that there really is a distinction between fact and fiction. Because if you can't make that distinction, we lose any sense of what politics means. As Hannah Arendt said many, many years ago, I mean, thoughtlessness is the basis for fascism. And the basis for thoughtlessness is not having an informed opinion, not knowing how to make an argument, not knowing what evidence means, simply reducing everything to your own private orbit and world of a kind of fictionalized reality. This is the land of Goebbels. This is not just about fake news. I mean, let's be historical here. I mean, what do these arguments emulate? I mean, they emulate fascist governments that did everything they can to lie to people, to lead them to believe that, for instance, Jews were inferior, that basically colonies mattered, that white men were the only people who should rule the earth. It's not the first time we've heard this stuff, but it's the first time where we've heard it at the highest levels of power in a markedly shameful and unapologetic way.
You have a wonderful gift with words, Henry, and it's such a pleasure to read your essays and your books because of that. But your words are often polysyllabic, and I can't help but notice that there is a pretty strong strain of anti-intellectualism in this country, and many of your suggestions for how to overcome the issues that we've just been discussing is education and is critical thinking and learning to think. But how does one combat anti-intellectualism?
It's a wonderful question, and as you well know, it's an amazingly layered question, it demands a number of answers beyond the simplistic, we need more education. I think the first thing that we have to ask ourselves is, you know, why does education matter? And I think many of us will agree that it matters because you can't have a democracy without informed citizens. It's just not going to exist. Secondly, the question that has to be raised is, what are the institutions that need to be supported that make this possible? And I think we need to talk about what it means to fund public education and of course, higher education. Thirdly, we need to ask ourselves, what forms of education exist outside of schooling that are possible to both promote forms of civic literacy, relational thinking, critical thinking, and we need to begin to identify those. Fourthly, we need to then ask ourselves, what are the forces that are doing everything they can to destroy education at both the formal and the larger sphere of what we would call the cultural apparatuses, the media. So I think that those kinds of issues have to be addressed as central to what it means to live in a democracy before we can talk about education in very simplistic terms. It has to be defended. I mean, it has to be seen as central to politics itself. It has to be seen as something that is so crucial to one's agency, the possibility of being in the world self-reflectively and being able to act on that world with a sense of moral and political responsibility. And I think that in many ways, even the left has given up the notion of education. And we talk about domination in terms of structures, economic, political, and otherwise. But what we don't talk about enough is the question of consciousness. You know, Vaclav Havel had a great expression. He said, politics follows culture. And he was absolutely right in my mind. And that translates into consciousness, opens up a door where people can be more self-reflective about themselves and the world they live in. That's an educational issue. Hence, you have to write in ways that are accessible. Hence, you have to speak to people in ways in which they can recognize a language in which their own needs can be analyzed. You have to appeal to people in ways that don't promote shame, but promote inquiry, that raise questions. And regarding your earlier question, yeah, you're going to find people who are just outright unrepentant racists who don't care about anything but their own opinion. And I'm not sure those people matter. I mean, I think there are others who are caught in complications that they don't understand and are open to possibilities. And that's where our efforts should go. I'm not really concerned about diehard Nazis. I have no interest in talking to them. I mean, people who are talking about, you know, resurrecting the Third Reich and Sieg Heil and all that stuff, the alt-right, there's always fringes that are gone. Don't focus on the fringes. Focus on the people who basically are trying to figure this all out and might have voted for Trump, but don't consider themselves racist or are attracted to the Republican Party platform, but really don't have a deep understanding of how it represents a form of injustice and actually will do more harm to them than they realize. I mean, we have to find pedagogical spaces and apparatuses that enable that, public spheres that bring people together so that a dialogue can take place in ways that are not wrapped in hatred, bigotry, and racism. We focus too much on the racism as something that we need to address in terms of its most extremist components. I'm not interested in talking to the extreme right. They don't interest me. They only interest me in terms of getting rid of them, getting rid of the conditions that produce them.
We are in a period where women are, after many, many millennia, and not to mention decades, seem to be at a moment where we are speaking out and sharing our collective experience of assault, abuse, harassment. And at this very same moment, there is an election that will be happening in the next 2 weeks, basically, in Alabama. And 9 women have come forward to allow themselves to be named and give evidence that one of the candidates, Roy Moore, at least harassed them and some say assaulted them. And yet, many, many people, including the woman governor of Alabama, say she is going to vote for Roy Moore because it's more imperative that a Democrat not take that seat than a potential, possible, alleged child molester. And this is the state of politics, at least in that one election. But it plays out, as you already mentioned with the tape, all the way up to the presidential election. I remind our listeners that not only was there that evidence of his own voice talking about assaulting women, but there were, I can't remember the number, but it was more than a dozen women who alleged that he had assaulted them. In addition to all the other isms you mentioned, there is also sexism, and that is also a global phenomenon. I wonder what you can share with us of your thoughts on that.
I think this is an enormously watershed moment when women collectively are finding their voices and refusing to be passive in the face of that kind of rancid assault. And I think that the real issue here is now to move from outrage to a movement. You know, to basically have women and others organize against this viral form of militarism and hypermasculinity, this punitive disregard for women, in ways that see it as one more form of oppression that has to be eliminated if a democracy is going to come into being. And I think that people who believe in these testimonies and what they represented on the largest scale in terms of a form of systemic, feral sexism, all of a sudden, you know, I mean, it seems to me it's another way of raising a complaint about a specific form of oppression, but at the same time realizing that if you're going to do anything about it, you've got to join with other groups to create a political and social formation that's powerful enough to address all of these under the banner of a radical democracy. My biggest fear about these movements is that they're moments and not sustained demonstrations. And even as sustained demonstrations, they become isolated in terms of political, they become political silos. I mean, you can't talk about sexism when you talk about racism. You can't talk about both of those without talking about inequality and power. And we've got to learn to think in a more comprehensive way to both name these emerging forms of oppression, emerging only in that people have been silenced to address them or have refused to address them, and bring them together in a totality, a kind of comprehensive understanding of politics, so we can understand how they get reinforced by other forms of oppression, so the system itself can be eliminated. We can eliminate sexism, but it doesn't mean a lot if you still have a racist society. You know, it doesn't mean a lot if you still have a society marked by massive forms of inequality, because it'll just come back under those conditions. That's all. I think that this is a really, really interesting moment, and I'm hoping that it moves to something larger and all of a sudden becomes another powerful force in calling for a third party, at the very least, that's going to operate under the banner of democratic socialism.
That brings up the whole concept of third parties, which historically in this country have never really gotten anywhere, and attempts at them have often swung an election in surprising ways. How do you envision that as a potentially useful activity?
It seems to me that it's really a matter of whether you want to work and accommodate yourself within a system that has two parties that are absolutely wedded to the financial elite and have no interest in democracy whatsoever, or if you want to be able to reimagine a society in which those parties don't have any power. And I think that in the most immediate sense, you could say, oh, historically, they failed. But, you know, there have been a lot of instances in history, as Marx once said, where history is open. Nobody thought the Berlin Wall would fall. Nobody thought the Soviet Union would crumble. You know, there's a whole range of revolutions that nobody thought would take place. Spain, Podemos. I mean, I think you have to take a risk. You have to take a chance. You have to think in terms of the long haul and not in terms of the short term. And I think that given what's at stake, I think talking about the possibility of a third party, in spite of what's happened in the past, has a lot of merit. And I also think that the contradictions now are so severe, and that we're, you know, in the midst of a raging form of American authoritarianism, I'm not sure we have a choice.
You were awarded an honorary doctorate at the University of West Scotland, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that.
Yeah. When you're old, they give you awards, because they think you're too old to be a threat anymore.
Well, there was a video which listeners can view if they go to your website. There's a link to it there, and it didn't look to me as if they were only doing it because...
I'm just kidding.
Okay, good.
They were very gracious, and I was very honored.
Here is something that listeners will be interested in. We were talking about intellectuals and anti-intellectualism. You revealed in that speech where you come from as a person. You grew up in a working-class family in Providence, Rhode Island, and you weren't a very good student. Discuss the only reason you actually were able to go to college. It wasn't because of your good grades.
No, actually, I wasn't a bad student. I was a good student, but I wasn't in the college track. We were track. Working class kids were track. I went to college because I had a basketball scholarship. I was an athlete. I mean, it was the reason that I was able to escape from that neighborhood. There were a couple of people who intervened in my life in ways that now has become like a Hollywood story. There was a guy, an Italian guy, my guidance teacher, another person, and they said, look, you know, you're smart, you should go to college, you should do what you can. And I had no understanding of that. I mean, I was going to become a cop or a fireman or a priest. They were the only options really open to us. And so when people often ask me, you know, how did you do it? I said, you know, it's by luck. And even getting my doctorate was odd and strange because and a matter of circumstance, because I attended a lecture while I was a high school teacher by Ted Fenton. And I asked three or four questions at the end of the talk, and he came running up after the talk, and he said, how would you like to get a doctorate at Carnegie Mellon? And I said, yeah, great. And that's how it happened.
In that video, one of the people who were interviewing you brought up a photograph of the horrible burning of the Grenfell Towers in London and how many people died unnecessarily there. And he asked you the question, how does one teach to the Grenfell Towers? And we could then extrapolate that to the issues here in the United States and use the massacre in Las Vegas. How does one teach to the massacre in Las Vegas?
factors? You know, what are the conditions that make this possible? And you know, how do you address them? I mean, what happens when people try to save money by not putting in the safety features that are necessary to prevent a building from burning down? I mean, what? How do you talk about violence outside of simply the language of psychology? You know, how do you talk about the fact that people can commit a crime like that only because they have access to weapons that should never be legally available to anyone? And so I think that the real question here for me has always been, how do you translate what appears to be a private issue into a larger issue addressing systemic factors? You know, the militarization of American society, the institutionalization of violence, the violence seen now as a sport, violence seen as the only form of aesthetic pleasure, which is really a form of aesthetic vulgarity that seems to be left in American culture. And I think that, you know, there's an attempt to try to bring these things together and to say, hey, look, this is not an aberration. This is an outgrowth of something that we should expect, given the conditions that are available, that we're able to produce it.
Just today in The Guardian, there's a headline, U.S. gun violence spawns a new epidemic, conspiracy theorists harassing victims. And it's an extremely shocking phenomenon that isn't new. The parents who lost children at the Sandy Hook massacre have been plagued by these conspiracy theorists who are claiming that it never happened, Sandy Hook never happened, that in Las Vegas it was actors who were pretending the massacre happened. This is so off the charts in terms of cruelty and just psychopathy that I cannot get my brain around it. But it's a phenomenon, Henry. What can you tell us?
No, I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, it suggests something about the hardening of the culture that is almost unimaginable. It suggests the erasure and the elimination and the scornful attitude towards compassion, towards the need to basically help others, the need to recognize in others parts of ourselves, the need to in some way embrace as part of any civilized society a notion of moral and social responsibility that seems to be fading and creating Frankenstein monsters everywhere. And I think that, you know, we need to look at this country in terms of what we've done to sort of emphasize, as you said earlier, a kind of, regarding Roy Moore, a kind of pragmatism that seems to be scornful of any notion of ethical judgment. You know, we're going to vote for him because even though he may be a serial sex offender, we're going to vote for him because it's pragmatic not to vote for a Republican. I mean, this is the language of dead people. This is the language of the walking dead. This is the language of zombies. You know, what creates zombies? I mean, what's going on in our society that allows this kind of cruel zombie-like culture of the walking dead to sort of gain power or to, in a sense, produce acts that are unimaginable? I mean, something is seriously wrong with the culture. Something is seriously wrong with the commanding visions that now dominate the culture. Something is wrong with the institutions and the politicians who support this stuff. A kind of psychopathic authoritarian ideology has now gripped the country and is being reproduced endlessly, and the fallout and the collateral damage from that is precisely what you've talked about. People enjoying themselves by imposing violence on others. When violence becomes the only measure of how a relationship should be addressed, when violence becomes the only form of pleasure left that we can resort to in order to feel something, you're in a society that's basically psychopathic.
You have also use the term democracy fatigue. What do you mean by that, and how big a part do you think that is in our situation?
Well, I use the term not to suggest that democracy has no value. I use the term to suggest that people who use it often use it in a way that has nothing to do with democracy, and that people get confused about what it means. I mean, when you start to tell people that freedom is really about the freedom to shop, and not about the freedom to think, about the freedom to intervene, about the freedom to produce the kind of society that benefits everyone, something happens. Democracy loses its meaning. And I think that, you know, we find ourselves living in a society at the present moment in which we have no language for democracy. We have no language for community. You realize that when Trump was inaugurated, look for the word freedom and democracy in his speeches. They're not there. He doesn't use them. And I think we've gotten to the point where these terms are so scornful, so threatening, that we will do everything we can to eliminate the public spheres and the formative culture that give any meaning to them. That's why there's the attack on public schools. That's why there's the attack on higher education. That's why there's an attack on social provisions. That's why there's an attack on health care. We don't want people who are healthy. We don't want people who are smart. We don't want people who can think critically. We want people, as Trump said, who are dumb, who, you know, the uneducated, who are incapable of thinking and actually don't want to think. And I think that when you get a president and a government that operates according to the notion of fake news, alternative realities, and constantly operates like a fifth grader who is obsessed with tweeting just so he can taunt people, it's an indication of the degree to which politics has lost any meaning. It's not politics, it's anti-politics. It's not about governing, it's not about governance. It's about the corruption of politics. And I think that questions now have to be raised about who's complicit in this, who produces this, and who benefits from it, and how that can change.
Oh, that's interesting you use the word complicit, because Dictionary.com has named that as the word of the year for 2017. The things you've just said are pretty well illustrated in this tax bill that is going through Congress now. It increases military spending, and at the same time, graduate student tuition waivers are eliminated. That means that they don't have to pay tuition in lieu of working, but they get taxed on the tuition they don't have to pay. The student loan interest deduction is eliminated. The lifetime education deduction is eliminated. And even money that teachers spend buying supplies, and I understand the average amount of money in the United States that teachers spend buying school supplies for their students is $500. That deduction is eliminated. So what can one think except that this is a pretty overt expression of what you have called the demonization of higher education?
I don't think there's any question. I mean, look, who's the Secretary of Education? Betsy DeVos, a billionaire religious fanatic who believes that education should deliver students to God's kingdom. She's quoted on that. I think that this administration and its bulldogs, Mulvaney and all of them, just bulldogs. These are not people who care about students. These are not people who care about young people, the public goods, higher education. These are people who want to destroy these institutions. And they basically want to do everything they can to convert young people into good soldiers for neoliberalism, good soldiers for religious fanatics. I mean, they don't care about a generation that is going to be educated, is going to be have the conditions they need to be really thoughtful citizens. They want to do everything they can to eliminate that. I mean, I think the thing that really shocks me about this bill is what it does to children. I mean, if you read Marion Wright Elderman, you know, just go to her website. She has a piece that came out recently called Why America May Go to Hell. And she documents the number of children who, I mean, 14.8 million children struggle against food insecurity in this country. And we're wiping out food stamps? I mean, we're taking away health care for young people, giving all this money to the rich? If children, the way a society treats children, is the ultimate index of how a society judges itself, this society, and particularly with this budget, is cruel, dehumanizing, and evil. It has completely failed our children. And it has made very clear that it has no interest in helping the vulnerable, the poor, young people, and it has every interest in basically filling the pockets of the rich, who really don't even need this money. They have so much money, they're making so many profits, right? So the profits are so high right now, it's like a joke. But it tells you something about the corruption of politics. And it tells you something about a capitalist system that basically is more concerned about greed than it is about justice.
I promised Henry at the beginning that we were going to explore some of the ways in which we can engage in a politics of hope. And you have pointed out that although the media is controlled by the corporations, the government is controlled by the corporations. We are at a point in history where the means of communication have been globalized. Right. Please talk about that.
For all the talk about despair, I mean, one of the things that we have to realize that history is open. You know, power is never entirely about domination. And I think the contradictions are so overwhelming at this time, really, not only in the United States, but even in Europe, the tsunami of bigotry and hatred and fascism that's emerging has really mobilized all kinds of people who basically would never have been mobilized. I mean, there's a story that appeared the other day about the biggest resistance movement in the red states, and people would often say, oh, it's the Black Lives Matter movement. No, it's not. It's actually educated white women between the ages of 35 and 45 who are doing everything they can to win elections and to take power away from the right-wingers. I mean, that's unreal to me. Then you look at the various youth movements, and the thing that's so striking about these movements is that they're international. They're not just simply locally based. They're trying to learn from Palestinians. They're trying to learn from other oppressed groups. And they have access to a technology that allows them to communicate in a way in which it becomes very difficult for the state to shut them down. Although, of course, the FCC is now, with net neutrality, is trying to eliminate some of that. But I think that the other side of this, in respect to a direct answer to your question, is that the modes of communication have opened up in ways we have never seen before. We now actually have alternative media sites that will interview people like me, that will interview people like Noam Chomsky. I mean, you realize that 15, 20 years ago, about 10 people knew who I was. I couldn't get published anywhere. The Nation wouldn't publish me. These people wouldn't publish me. Even Common Dreams won't reprint my work. I mean, liberals are more scared of people on the left than they are of people on the right. And I think that once we realize this, then we realize how urgently it's needed is for radio stations and programs like yourself. I mean, programs that are fierce, courageous, willing to address the truth, and open up possibilities for people to learn and in some way learn new languages and new ways of understanding the world that may change their lives. I get emails all the time from people saying, oh, my God, thank you. I read this. I heard this. It really meant something to me. And so I'm very hopeful about that. I'm hopeful about the fierceness of the resistance. I'm hopeful about the way young people are both technologically inclined and at the same time far more cosmopolitan than they've been in the past. I'm hopeful about the fact that middle-aged people and others are starting to realize that their way of life is coming to an end, that democracy is truly threatened in a way like we've never seen before, and that there's no escape from resistance. Resistance is not an option. It's a necessity, as I've said many times, and I think we see that happening.
To that, I can add that the Public Service Commission, I believe it is, in North Dakota, although they technically granted a permit to TransCanada for the Keystone XL pipeline, they disallowed the route that had originally been asked for. At the very least, this throws the process back probably years. In the meantime, both TransCanada and a citizens group in North Dakota has appealed this decision, at the very least for clarification. So that's a holding motion. Here in Bozeman, Montana, there was an effort for a Koch-funded Center for the Study of Regulation here at Montana State University. The Faculty Senate could have grabbed the money because, heaven knows, education funding is drying up. They tabled that decision, which some people believe that it will never be brought back, but we'll wait and see on that. Young people have sued the federal government for failure to protect their future and have been granted standing in the federal court because of that. That's moving on. As you alluded to, there are people of a different bent who are beginning to seek public office at the grassroots level, and a surprising number are being elected. We are almost out of time, Henry Giroux. I want to give you the last minute for any final words.
I think that one of the great things that I see, and I'm very hopeful about, is that people who are rich, people who are powerful, think they can just write people out of democracy. Well, I'm sorry. That's not going to happen. And I think that people are waking up, of all ages, of all faiths, all religions, all political ideologies, and are starting to say, hey, look, the United States is at war with itself. And we basically have to make sure that democracy does not die. It's not going to die. It's fragile. It's on life support, but it's going to come back. And I think that basically that's what we're going to see in the next few years. I'm hopeful and I'm excited.
You make me hopeful and excited, too. Henry Giroux, thank you again for joining us on Forthright Radio and for your many decades of work helping us to understand these issues and move on towards action.
Thank you, Joy. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Professor Henry Giroux, McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest. His latest book is Earth at War with Itself, published by City Lights Books. His book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, is to be published in 2018 by Routledge. And a final quote from Hannah Arendt. The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the dedicated communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, true and false, no longer exists. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX and Z's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Alice Wolfe, I'm Joy LeClaire.